Welcome to the Association Strong podcast, where we offer insight from both a seasoned association exec and an entrepreneur. I'm Dave Will.
And I'm Tom Morrison. Listen in as we discuss and debate hot topics in the association community. Don't forget to subscribe and share us with your friends.
Tommy Bahami, here we are again.
I know, man. I love it. I flew back in last night about 7:30 from Napa Valley. And I'm excited today because we have a guy we're talking to that represents all the airport executives that got me there. So I'm excited to hear their story today.
So we've got Todd Hoptley. Did I say that right? Hoptley?
Hoptley. Yep.
Hoptley. And Todd is the president and CEO of AAAE, which is the American Airport. Wait a minute. I think I have that wrong. Airport Executives. Please.
American Association of Airport Executives.
Thank you.
That sounded so easy when he said that.
It is so easy, Tom. It's so, and this is embarrassing because they're a client of ours, and I couldn't get those words out of my mouth. Anyway, I was a little hesitant to have somebody so inexperienced on our podcast, Tom. Todd only has had one job, and from what I can tell. And so I don't know if he's gonna have much to contribute. He's been at this one place for 33 years.
Wow. There's yeah, something to said for that.
I guess so. I guess we'll see if he has anything to contribute. I mean, but one job, you know, what does he know? One job.
One lousy job.
So what'd you do before AAA, the airport executives, Todd?
I worked on Capitol Hill, I worked at the Department of Transportation, I worked at the Department of Commerce, and I worked on the White House staff of Ronald Reagan.
Oh, you did have other jobs. So those are pretty impressive jobs. How come I don't see those in LinkedIn? I would be bragging about those.
Oh, well, you know, you've been one place for a long time.
You don't want to date yourself, I think, is what you're doing.
Well, Todd, you before we got on here, you mentioned something very intriguing I thought that would be interesting to our listeners. So you said you and I have something in common and that our associations have been around for over 90 years. We just celebrated our 90th this past year. You celebrated your 95th and coming up on 100, which is exciting. But your association's only ever had three executive directors, CEOs. Ours has only had four in their history. And I think there's something to be said for that stability within an organization, being able to keep engagement, member excitement that long. I mean, so share what that means to your group.
Sure. Well, AAA was founded in 1928, and for the first couple of decades, they didn't have a permanent full-time staff or staff leader. But back in 1958, they finally hired their first one, and that gentleman went from 58 to 83. The next guy went from 83 to 2013. Big, long, impressive run. And then I took over as CEO in 2013. And if God willing, I'll go till at least 2028, which is our 100th anniversary, where we'll be able to sort of turn the reins over at that point to the fourth leader of the organization and start a second century at AAAE.
Well, Todd, we'll have to stay in touch because my retirement date is December 31st, 2028. So we'll be able to celebrate together, my friend.
I like it. We'll crack a good bottle of wine.
Yeah.
Hey, Tom, I have a question for you. You run MTI, Metal Treating Institute. Mm-hmm. What percentage of your revenue comes from dues, Tom?
Roughly 72%. It fluctuates between 70 and 75%.
Do you want to take a... Is that... So your trade association... I suspect for trade associations that number is very, very high. I don't know what it is for most professional associations, but needless to say, what do you think, what percentage of Todd's association, AAAE, what percentage of their revenue do you think comes from dues?
I would have no idea, but I'd venture to say it's probably
low. It's very, very low. Very low. And Todd, correct me if I'm wrong. Is it 3%? Is that correct?
It's actually less than 2%.
Oh my God. So less than 2% of their revenue comes from dues. They're a $130 million organization. Is that right?
128 last year. We'll crack 130 something. We'll be in the 130s or so in 2024.
So 130.
Which begs the question, plus. Todd, what are you doing over dues that generates that kind of jack?
Let's start there. Great question.
Let's just start right there, because that's what I want to know.
Sure. So a long time ago, the leaders of the organization determined that they wanted low dues, low barriers to entry, that anybody that was in the airport executive, airport management, that worked at an airport could be a member of AAAE. So dues have been extremely low for a very long time. We haven't increased them in over a quarter of a century. Dues are $275 a person, or if you're a corporate member, they're $850. And that generates a couple million dollars a year in revenue for us. The rest of it all comes from the provision of products and services, solutions that airports decide whether we're the best provider or somebody else is the best provider of those services. So we're a nonprofit, but we are as close to a profit-making organization as you can be in the nonprofit space. And that was, frankly, one of the things that drew me to the invitation to have this conversation, because I really liked that intersection of entrepreneurial activity and nonprofit management.
So quick story, Dave, real quick before we move on. So my
aunt, I'm not moving on. I want to drill down into that a little bit.
Right. My aunt is an 80-year-old and woman, retired from the banking industry in SunTrust Bank here in the Southeast region. And we were just together on my 60th birthday cruise last week, and we were talking, and she's become the executive director of her grandson's motorcycle league. And they got, you know, a pretty decent budget, you know, for the motorcycle league of like $500,000 or, you know, or something. She's helped build that. But she said that since she's come on board, the revenues and net reserves have like doubled. You know, she's helped make it a very big success. And she looked at me and said, but we're trying to figure out how to spend the money because our board thinks we're putting too much money in the bank as a nonprofit. And I'm like, no, that's not the answer. You don't try and find ways to spend money because you're making it, because nonprofits can have as much money in the bank as long as they can justify it's going towards the purpose of the association. So it was a real eye opener. And this is just a little $500,000 association. You got $130 million association. So I'm interested to hear how your board has really kind of dealt with that over the years, because it's been growing, I would imagine, for a long period of time, correct?
Well, when I was interviewing for the job 10 years ago, we were a $33 million a year organization. And I said to the selection committee, I hope you'll select me because I think I'm best positioned to lead the organization going forward. And if you do select me, we're going to turn AAAE into a $100 million organization by 2028, our 100th anniversary. And they kind of looked at me like, oh, aren't you cute? That's adorable. But I'm a big, big believer that if you get great people aligned around a common vision, committed to excellence, you can achieve amazing results. And we grew from $33 million a year to $100 million a year, not in 15 years, but we did it in 5 years. And we've grown, you know, over the past couple of years. We had a big dip down during the pandemic. We went from $107 million a year down to $52 million a year in revenue. And believe me when I tell you, you can feel that. It was pretty brutal going through all of that, as it was for, you know, virtually everybody. But we've been growing back. And last year, again, top line revenue was $128 million. And the beauty for us as a nonprofit is we don't have shareholders to reward, obviously. We have members to reward. So we're able to take the success of our business operations and, yes, put some of that in the bank and grow our reserves, but we're also able to use a lot of that money that we generate in terms of a profit and turn it back to improve member benefits. We have a foundation where we issue lots of scholarships. We began a program of professional development grants where we bring people in to a lot of our conferences and meetings. We run 50 meetings a year of all different shapes and sizes all around the country and a number of meetings internationally. And we're able to bring now, through these professional development grants, people in where they wouldn't otherwise be able to get the support in their from their airport to participate. And we pick up their airfare and their registration fee and all of that for them. And we try and identify people who are earlier in their careers and get them involved with us. They get sticky early and they go along for the ride with us. And a lot of them started off in positions that were fairly junior in their organization. And as they've grown, they've become bigger supporters of ours. Now we have people who took these professional development grants early in their career, and now they're committee chairs of our organizations. We even got some board members now who were beneficiaries at these professional development grants, you know, a number of years ago. So it's been a real success story for us.
Todd, can you bring me back? What year did you say you started as? I know you were there before this, but yeah. you started as CEO.
In 2013.
In 2013. So 2013, you go to the board and you say, we're going to be $100 million. They snicker. They think you're adorable. What did you do over the next year or two? Tell me about the very first stage of your leadership.
Yep.
What did you do to spark tripling in size in a 5-year window?
Well, the very first thing I did, which I would recommend this to new incoming leaders, is I sat down after I was selected, but before I technically began as CEO, I sat down with every single member of the team. So at that point, we were about 75 people. And I sent
and
out-
And how big are you now?
We're actually 65 people now, less people. During the pandemic,
that's
we went
crazy.
From 70 something down to 52 people. Now we're up to 65 people. We've figured out how to work smarter, I think.
That's incredible. You're more efficient and four times the size. Yeah.
So we sat down. I sent everybody 4 or 5 questions in advance of these one-on-one sessions. And they ranged the same 4 or 5 questions to everybody on the team. And I sat down with everybody for half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour. And I told them, look, I'm going to listen mostly. I'm going to take some notes. And so everybody had a chance to share with me their, you know, sense of the future of the organization, what they felt like they needed in terms of resources, what they hoped I would do as CEO, what are the things that we needed to keep, what are the things we needed to junk, what are the things that we needed to improve on? Those kinds of questions. And you could feel it immediately. You know, you synthesize all that information after you've done a couple of weeks of this and you sit down with everybody. And it does, in my view at least, it does a couple of important things. One, it gives everyone a voice and everyone feels like they've had input into the direction going forward. You as the leader get a pretty good sense of everybody in the building and their capabilities. And then you can identify some low-hanging fruit, the easy stuff to fix. And you do that and you get some early wins along the way and you can build a sense of momentum and a certain cadence and people feel like, oh, this is different.
Can you give me an example of one of those?
You know, a little, I'm trying to think of some of this, you know, just some little things even about, you know, why are we doing these meetings in this way? Wouldn't it be more efficient if we did it that way instead?
Right.
Process kinds of things that would drive people crazy. Well, okay, so you fix that and all of a sudden you've made their life better because it's a little more efficient and they can go do other things. And so you did that and then what I did is I shared with everybody this notion of we're going to grow. I'm a big fan of history and I grew up reading lots of history and lots of biography. And on the first day, I, as the CEO, when we gathered as the staff, I told the story of Jefferson and atoms and their interactions and their kind of friends, and then there were enemies and their kind of frenemies. And, you know, after Jefferson has done all of his public service and he's retired to Monticello, and he and Adams are going back and forth in correspondence, you know, Jefferson writes and says, "I like the dreams of the future better than the history of the past." And I told everybody that story on the first day. And I said, we want to honor the past. We want to honor what brought us to where we are, but we want to dream big. We want to have impact. That is the way I measure things in a nonprofit organization. When you're mission driven, is impact. How can we as a team be the most impactful for our members? And it gave people license, I think, to go out and do more than they had been asked to do in the past. Again, I had an advantage coming in because I'd worked with everybody already. So I knew that there were a lot of people around the building who were capable of more than they had been asked of. And so I was essentially allowing people the opportunity to do more and to dream bigger. You know, I view one of the responsibilities of a nonprofit leader, and I think it's the same in the for-profit world. I just don't have as much experience there. But, you know, you got to assume that everybody, once they get hired and get through that hiring process, they're capable of doing their job, the blocking and tackling of their job. But I think the role of the leader is to unlock that potential, unlock that capability that's beyond that, where people have this extra increment of discretionary effort that they are going to decide whether or not they're going to voluntarily, willingly, enthusiastically give that to the organization. And if you can create an environment and a climate and a culture where people want to do that, where they want to give you that extra effort, where they want to be part of something bigger than themselves, then it's almost unlimited what you can accomplish.
Now, did you take that and take all that input and then consolidate it and present a new vision to where you're going to take the organization?
Yeah. Oh, we had, I called it Hopley University, and we had innovation symposiums where we brought everybody together and we talked about what we were going to bet on going forward. What were the things that we were going to try and do in terms of technology refreshes, product refreshes, new things? We knew we couldn't grow. You can't grow beyond incremental growth without new products and services. At least that's been my experience. So, you know, we knew that we were going to need to come up with solutions. So again, one of the things we did was try and empower people closest to the customers. All of our folks who are out there running these meetings, providing training services for our members, and really get them to ask our members, our clients, our customers, what do you need? What are your pain points? How can we help? And I think we did a good job of putting our listening ears on and really responding to what the marketplace needed.
So I got a big question.
Tom, I've got so many questions. So you go get one.
So it's one thing for you to tell your board we're going to go from 30 million to 100 million. It's a whole nother, because they're kind of removed from the process, their policy, their strategy. But it's another to sit down with your team and go, hey, we're going to grow from 33 million to 100 million in 5 to 10 years. And they're like, I'm already working hard. You know how much work that's going to be. So what was that experience like looking at your staff?
And we're going to do it with a third less of you.
Right.
Well, we didn't think we were going to have to do it with a third less of you.
Triple in size, even with current levels of staff, will freak most staffs out.
I think people were, yes, people, you always worry about burnout and people thinking, oh my gosh, what does this mean in terms of new responsibilities? But again, if you've got the right kind of culture, and I can't claim credit for creating the culture at AAA. It existed before I came. It's been passed on over the decades from staff to staff. It really is a member-forward, member-focused culture of providing solutions and exceeding expectations. And so we just said, you know, here are things we need to do, want to do. Where can we be better? Where can we take existing products and services that we have and look at different adjacent verticals? I call them the adjacency sessions, where we looked at things where we could, you know, like I said, take what we've already done, tweak it a little bit, and then plop and drop it in an adjacent vertical to expand our addressable market, rather than creating stuff brand new. We did that too, but that's always a lot harder. Let me give you an example. We used to have these video screens that we would have in the areas where you would be standing in line waiting to go through security. And we would have these messages and videos about how to divest, take all the stuff out of your pockets and all that to get through security. Well, TSA kind of took over that responsibility and took over that real estate. But we thought, that's still a good product. That's still a good solution out there. Where else could we use that? The American Association of Airport Executives has 37 Amtrak stations across the country where we have our technology in there, our messaging, our video system in place. And so you wouldn't think that Amtrak would be powered by the American Association of Airport Executives or a piece of the Amtrak puzzle by AAAE, but it is. So that's just one example. Another thing that we did that was a big revenue driver for us and a great service to our members is we worked with this, what was then the emerging rideshare experience, Uber and Lyft. And we worked with San Francisco Airport, which was right at the very tip of the spear on this, in creating a revenue tracking and management system dealing with the rideshare companies. Early on in the experience, Uber and Lyft were just coming onto airports, dropping people off, picking people up, upsetting the cab folks, getting in fights with people. The airport was not experiencing any of the revenue from these folks' activity on the airport property. And we worked, it was messy and, you know, uncomfortable initially for everybody, but we worked with the rideshare companies on coming up with a revenue tracking system. So now we know when an Uber or a Lyft comes on airport property, drops people off, picks people up, leaves airport property, airports. We collect a fee on behalf of the airport from the rideshare companies. We do all of our accounting and management and our secret sauce on there, auditing on all of it to make sure it's all correct. And then we remit to the airport those monies minus a little processing fee, a little handling fee. So we get a tiny little piece of many hundreds of thousands of transactions that occur on a monthly basis. That's great for our members because they don't have to hire enforcement people. They don't have to hire a bunch of new finance people to deal with all of this. We provide a great service. It puts us in the middle between companies that want to do business on the airport property and the airports themselves, and we help find solutions in that space. And we do that in lots of different parts of the experience of an airport.
That's incredible. That is fascinating to me. Now, in that particular example, my hunch is, correct me if I'm wrong, my hunch is part of that $130 million is all of the revenue coming in,
yep,
not just that small percentage that you take, but it's all the revenue coming in, but and a big chunk of that then goes out to the airports.
Yep. That's
true. By no means am I diminishing the value of the $130 million. It's an unbelievable model that you've created. I'm just trying to understand the numbers. That is incredible what you've done. And Tom, I've heard you talk about this in your speeches. Tom's a keynote speaker and he goes to a lot of association executive things and association events and speaks at those about trends of the future and how to be a healthier association. I've heard him talk about this, looking at all of the ways your association can impact the industry. Stop thinking solely about membership dues and your conference revenue and start thinking about how you can impact the industry. And it sounds like you're doing that. Are you utilizing partner companies to deliver these services, or are you're clearly not building your staff to deliver these services, so you must be working with your partner companies to deliver these services, is that right?
It depends on the different line of business. We have 15 different lines of business with the organization, 15 different revenue streams, and they all are a little bit different. In some instances we do it in-house, in other instances we partner with folks to help us on that. So it just kind of depends on which line of business. We do training, lots and lots of training and certification for folks. And we do a ton of that in-house ourselves, but we also have instructors that, outside instructors that we use. With the revenue, you know, the issue we were talking about with Uber and Lyft, we have a partner who helps us with a lot of that work as well. So it's like I said, it just depends. 15 different lines of business. Every one of them has a different margin. Every one of them is structured a little bit differently. And that's what makes it, frankly, a lot of fun to be the person in my position, because although it is as I said before, although it's a nonprofit organization, you know, we're really running a for-profit operation with lots of different lines of business.
Which begs the question from some people listening and me, so do you have a for-profit entity that is taking in the majority of that income and the association is the benefactor of it, or is it all running through the nonprofit?
We run it through, it's all running through nonprofit. We have, let me back up. Sorry, I answered that a little both ways. We have the Airport Research and Development Foundation, nonprofit, where we run a lot of these programs through.
Gotcha.
We do have a for-profit partnership that's separate, where we do some of this business, but a lot of the stuff is run through our Airport Research and Development Foundation. We also have, as I indicated earlier, we also have an educational foundation where we issue scholarships.
Right.
That's another area that we're really proud of. When I took over 10 years ago, we had a foundation that had a $2 million endowment. We now have an $8 million endowment. Years ago, we were giving out $174,000 a year in scholarships. Today, we're giving out over $500,000 a year in scholarships. We have 10 permanently endowed scholarships. It's a way for us to help feed the pipeline for the future to make sure that we have airport professionals for years to come.
Yeah, because everybody's doing the same thing. We're in the same market. I mean, we're in the same boat. We're trying to feed endowments to feed the future, because I mean, no one knows what it's like, and the future doesn't look bright for a lot of people in terms of the next realm of employees, because there's a lot of outside intangibles impacting the workforce. So I mean, everybody's got to find their market, and they got to really market it hard to make sure they've got the employees it takes to grow in the future for sure.
Hey Todd, you said you had 15 streams of revenue. I'm not going to ask you to remember all of them. That's putting you on the spot. If you can, that's great. I'd love to hear them. But can you give me, you know, four, five, six examples of those revenue streams?
Sure, absolutely. As I mentioned, we have the what we call ABT, the app-based transportation, the revenue management tracking system. We have a clearinghouse for background checks for aviation workers, airport and airline workers. You need to, if you're gonna be in the secure part of an airport, you need a badge. And in order to get a badge, you have to go through a clearance process. We aren't the ones who actually clear you, but we're the ones who help process and get all of that information together, and then we send it on to the FBI. So we're, as a technical matter, we're called the designated channeler. So we have that transportation security clearinghouse that we operate. I mentioned that we run lots of meetings. Our annual conference is a 2,500 person meeting. We have that on the high end. We have a number of conferences that'll be 1,500, 1,000 people, 750, 500 people, all the way down to workshops that might have 25 or 30 people and everything in between. We run about 50 of those a year. So there's pretty much every week or so, there's something that we're doing, which means we have a pretty big conference department. We do some international meetings as well. So that's another one. Interactive employee training systems where we will either do custom video training for folks or more generic training. Big part of what we do as well. We have a magazine. We've got our federal affairs advocacy folks who do a lot of work. And we've, although it is a loss leader for us, we don't bring in as much revenue from that as we expend on behalf of the members. We do ask for voluntary contributions from our members to help offset the costs associated with all the advocacy efforts in Washington. So those are five or six of the biggest ticket items for us.
Now, where did these, I mean, these are really interesting ideas. I can't imagine they all just popped out of your head. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they did. Where did all these ideas come from over time?
Well, again, a lot of it is really listening to the members. And the sweet spot, in my view at least, the sweet spot in if you can get it in any association is if you can be in the middle with the members on one side who have problems that need solutions, and then your corporate members and partners who all have solutions that they're interested in helping to provide. If you can be in the middle of all of that helping, you're doing a great service for your members. And in some instances, you know, we're in there providing the solutions rather than a for-profit entity providing those solutions. And our members aren't going to pick us just because they like us. We have to have best-in-class solutions. But if we have them, we have an advantage because they know that there's this virtuous cycle where if they provide us the resources to help solve their problems, we don't have a profit motive in the same way that a nonprofit, that a profit for-profit organization does. Our profit motive is to serve the members. So they know that if they use us for our clearinghouse, use us for our app-based transportation solution, use us for training, use us for certification, all that money kind of stays in the ecosystem, the membership ecosystem, and we're going to turn around and use that to their benefit to provide more scholarships, more solutions, more professional development grants, more benefits to the members.
Hey Tom, I've got three boys, and I
Right.
don't have a favorite, but I do have a favorite podcast episode. This is 50, 60 podcasts or some have we done. Todd, this hands down, with no disrespect to anyone else that's been on this podcast, I've found this one to be the most fascinating. And I could probably go on for hours with questions. And I mean that sincerely. I have so many questions that I have for you. In fact, I hope to continue the conversation, at the very least one-on-one with you over time. One more question I want to ask about this in particular is, when I say this, I mean all these initiatives that brought you from 30-some million to 130 or so million. Were there any initiatives that you've tried and just completely failed? I would imagine there would have to be some.
Yeah, we've tried a couple things that haven't worked as well. And just like Silicon Valley, you want to fail fast and move on, right? You want to go from the ideation to trying something. If it works, great. If it doesn't, move on. One of the things that government doesn't do well is government doesn't cancel programs. They just keep going with stuff, whether it works or not. And we run a pretty lean operation and don't have the luxury of pouring a ton of time and an energy and effort into things that aren't working. So when we try something and it doesn't work, we say, okay, we learned something from that. Let's move on.
Tom, how are you doing? Do you have more questions?
Well, what's fascinating to me about this whole, and I know why it's fascinating to you, Dave, but I'm just sitting here just with a lot of things going through my mind like you are, just that a nonprofit group took programs and listened to members and matched them up and went from 30, tripled in size. It should be a lesson to every association that you can do it if you're listening right. Every association member, there isn't one association member who isn't going to work every day with a million problems right here. Who can help me solve them? And you connect the dot that the association is where you should put your efforts and your money and invest in that if they got the right product, because they're spending that money back on you at the end of the day for even more good, as opposed to just that one thing that you're looking at. So the money they're making on your training is being used to pay scholarships that bring people to you. The money that they're making is paying to do advocacy work. But a for-profit entity, I'm all about for-profit, but in the reality, they're not spending that money back on you. They're buying their boats, their excess stuff, things that they want. You know, they're paying for their family, which is all well and good. But whenever an association has Class A products for you as a member or a person in the industry to invest in, you really should take a look at that, because you got to figure out how. Here's the thing, Todd. I think a lot of associations fall over themselves and their messaging is to how to connect that dot. They just keep selling the product, and they don't connect the dot that the product, when you buy it with us, helps us reinvest back into your company, your success, even past you buying the product. I think that's where they lose it a little bit. But I mean, hats off to you. I mean, I'm just sitting here in awe. Hats off to you for having, you're like Joe Namath saying, we're going to win the Super Bowl. We're going to win the Super Bowl. You came in and said, we're going to go from 30 million to 100 million. And they're all like, no, we're not. And you're like, you watch. So, hats off. This has been a great podcast to hear how it can be done, because it can be done.
Well, thank you, guys. You made my day. I get to talk about the team and the amazing work that they've done over the past decade, but decades before that, it really is a unique organization. I've worked in some pretty interesting jobs. I came to AAAE 33 years ago thinking I'd be here for 2 or 3 years. And the place is pretty magical and the team is amazing. And it's really an honor to be able to be the leader of the organization, this temporary steward of the culture of the organization here.
So here's what I want to ask real quick, Dave, on that. So it's 2028 and I attend your retirement party, and you're standing at the mic, Todd, and you're about to talk about the one thing, when you look back 38 years, the one thing that you say, you know what, if there's one thing I'm absolutely proud of and seeing what we've accomplished for the airport executives industry the last 38 years, what's that going to be?
It's going to be the legacy of the foundation and the growth and the way we have touched hundreds and thousands of lives and made the lives of our members and their families better, and that we've brought people to the industry to make sure that the next century of the organization is better than the first.
That's what there's, I think there's two, I love that, because there's one thing that I kept thinking through, because I keep promoting this to other associations, is when you go from $300,000 to $3 million in reserves, when you go from $30 million to $100 million, the one word that always comes to my mind is freedom. Because now your board has the freedom to invest in that scholarship fund. The board has the freedom to invest in that Jobs of Tomorrow project. Your board has the freedom to invest and take risk on your members' behalf that you never could do before because you didn't have the money. And now you do. And that's what I would think about why people say, I'm a mindset. I'm like Dave. That's why we kind of mix on this. Well, he's the entrepreneur in the for-profit world. I'm the entrepreneur mindset in the nonprofit. And I'm a big believer, just what you've done. You got to grow your reserves and your profits well enough that you can have the money to invest back into things that your members could not do on the, by themselves alone. And so it's just exciting hearing how you've done that.
Well said. Thank you.
So, Todd, what we do is we wrap up this podcast, and thank you. This one went a little longer than normal for obvious reasons, but we wrap this up where Tom and I will share a takeaway, some key takeaway from the conversation, and we'd love for you to participate in that. Was there an epiphany? Was there something that you realized that stands out to you, or is there a message that you want to leave the community with, our listener with? Tom, do you want to go first?
Yeah. So my big takeaway is one word, and it's boldness. Boldness from Todd thinking that he could get from 30 million to 100 million. And it's not so much to think it, but to actually say it to your board and say, we're going to be $100 million and watch their reaction. And then pull that off. To me, it takes boldness, and it's a big encouragement to me because I have that mindset to even do it more. And I think it should be an encouragement to those listening in that sometimes you have to step out and be bold if you're going to be successful in this highly competitive world, even as a nonprofit. So boldness is something that kept sticking on me as I listened to Todd's story.
So you asked me, Tom, or you stated that you didn't know what I found fascinating, but that's what you mentioned, went on to say, this is what I find fascinating a few minutes ago. I'll tell you, because this is my key takeaway, what I'm utterly fascinated by, and I don't mean to blow this much smoke. Tom knows I don't typically when we have a guest on. I don't know that I've ever met and had a conversation with a leader as impressive as you. And that's the biggest takeaway for me. This is for someone to come into an organization, and it's not about all the money. That's not what it's about. The money to me is, I always say this, and being a for-profit entrepreneur in a nonprofit space, money to me is a metric of value. Money isn't the means to buy a new boat or a bigger house or a pool. Money, it's not about greed. It's quite the opposite. I think there's a misconception, especially in the nonprofit space, that for-profit businesses are greedy. And that's just, to me, there's very few people that are greedy anywhere for that matter. I think for me, money is about representing value. It's a measure of value created. And you were able to step in, I would argue, single-handedly taking this organization with a big team and with the support of a board. You are able to redirect this organization in a massive shift. And to me, that is what's so impressive, is that journey. That's why I could ask you questions for hours about more wins, more fails, challenges you ran into along the way. We didn't even ask about your membership issues. We didn't even ask about that stuff. There's a lot more we could do. So that was my biggest takeaway, is the impact having a leader like you can make on an organization, and quite the contrary, the impact not having a leader like you can have on an organization. You see that all the time. More often than not, sorry for talking so much here, more often than not, non-leaders are leading organizations. It's very unusual to meet someone like you. Todd, do you have any key takeaways?
Well, I have two. One of them is you clearly need to get out more. But
Todd, listen, I have another podcast for Entrepreneurs Organization. I've interviewed a couple hundred people, including the founder of Reebok. I've interviewed a lot of people, Todd, and I say that as humbly as I can. I've interviewed many, many authors of books, including this guy here, Tom. The number of billionaires. I've interviewed billionaires. And I can tell you, you're up at the top in terms of the most impressive leaders I've ever met in my life. So, and I don't mean to blow smoke. It's just, it's to me, that's how I feel.
I'm extraordinarily flattered, and my defense mechanism is to deflect. So thank you very much for that. I'm humbled by that.
I would like to get out more too, by the way.
I would just take you back to something I said earlier, and I believe it. It's not false modesty. I absolutely believe it. Great people aligned around a common vision, committed to excellence, can achieve amazing results. And that's what I'm really proud of around here. It's not what I've done, it's what we've done.
Love that.
That's awesome. Love it.
You're right. Great people, great vision, excellence.
Yeah,
all right, Todd.
You know, real quick, just to wrap it up. So Todd, you're right on the money, because I've seen great leaders who are hungstruck by their staff and or their board. They could do the same things in a lot of cases, but their board won't let them have the freedom to do it. So you're exactly right that it really is a we thing, you know, because unless you've got a very innovative and open board to new ideas, or a staff that's willing to embrace change and technology. I mean, great Dave sees it all the time, and I do too. Great CEOs sit and go to waste because their ideas just sit on a shelf because their board just will not move forward.
Guys, this was great fun. I appreciate the opportunity to be on with you. And if you ever get desperate and need a return guest, I'd be happy to come back and
talk. Great talking to you, man.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
We hope you gained some inspiration that will help you run an efficient and effective association just like a business, and maybe laugh a little with us. If you have a topic you would like to hear us talk about, or if you just want to reach out to us for any reason, you can contact us at tom@tommorson.biz or dave@propfuel.com.
Give us a review if you haven't already, and don't forget, subscribe and share with your friends.